This would be a perfect time to provide their biggest-brained employees with a large ceremonial pat on the back. With that in mind, they've pulled out all the stops and converted one of their biggest aviation hangars into the setting for what has to rank as the most colossal pep rally in history. Enormous sections of the actual rocket that will one day carry man to the moon, plus full-scale mock-ups of Apollo 11, are sprinkled about the concrete floor of the hangar, sort of enormous party favors. Nearby, a buffet table roughly the size of Rhode Island strains under the weight of a potato salad hemisphere, sculpted to vaguely reproduce the lunar surface. An open bar lurks seductively between a seafood salad and the midsection of the rocket's fuselage. I'm above it all, hiding behind a maroon velvet stage curtain alongside future Apollo 11 inhabitants Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Buzz Aldrin. Flanking us are half a dozen of NASA's highest-ranking rocket scientist types. Below us, the honored engineers are taking their seats. The brainiest-looking of the scientists speak to the attendees, stroking them about what a great job they've done and urging them to keep up the good work. Meanwhile, the rest of us are killing time while we wait to be introduced. I've just completed writing See You on the Moon, Best Wishes, William Shatner on the side of a model kit version of the USS Enterprise, which was assembled by six high-ranking NASA types and presented to me by the trio of astronauts for my autograph. They tell me it will one day hang fuzzy dice style in the cockpit of the Apollo 11. Grinning uncontrollably at that flattering piece of trivia, I hand this thing back to Neil Armstrong, who thanks me and then watches in horror as the entire hull section of this plastic mini Enterprise falls to pieces, clattering to the concrete floor. Now, as I try my best not to laugh out loud, I watch some of NASA's very brightest rocket scientists huddling around their damaged dime store creation, brows furrowed, swearing over their own embarrassing inability to construct a model kit recommended for ages 8 and above. Finally, with the aid of some juicy fruit and masking tape, the faux Enterprise is whole once more, if a bit wobbly. Meanwhile, I can't help but notice that Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins have understandably gone a bit pasty. I mean, these guys have just bravely signed on for a trip to the moon to go literally where no man has gone before, only to then stare in horror at the handiwork of NASA's premier engineers self-destruct in their hands. At any rate, throughout the ensuing proceedings, there's verbal backslapping and ass-kissing all around, and one by one, the scientists and astronauts in waiting have their say, and toward the end of the festivities, I'm introduced. I emerge at last from behind that curtain, and I'm stunned by the thunderous ovation that greets me. These guys are literally standing on their chairs cheering. To receive this sort of overwhelming reception was beyond belief. Somehow, it just didn't seem credible that a make-believe space explorer should merit the center of attention amid these real-life heroes. At any rate, I spent the rest of my day at NASA like a kid in a candy store, climbing aboard the actual Apollo 11 lunar module and touring the base, all the while shaking hands, signing autographs, and posing next to the scientists and engineers as they passed instamatic cameras back and forth. By the time it was over, the sides of my face hurt from smiling. Late in the afternoon, I exchanged thank yous and goodbyes all around, then sped back toward the airport and climbed aboard a plane, pointed back toward L.A. Within a week, we'd begin shooting Star Trek's third season, and as this 727 shot westward, I found myself feeling really good about the show. My spirits had been buoyed tremendously by the events of the day. For the first time, I had seen irrefutable proof that, despite Star Trek's mediocre Nielsen numbers, the series was truly appreciated. Star Trek, I mused, was going to be around for a long time. July 20th, 1968, Los Angeles, California. Things have taken a decided turn for the worse. Almost immediately upon my return to L.A., I'm told NBC has made some last-minute revisions to its upcoming primetime lineup. Star Trek has been bumped to the network's television graveyard, Friday nights at 10. The time slot is a perennial loser for the network, and especially inappropriate for Star Trek, in that the majority of our audience is composed of kids and young adults. This new NBC schedule virtually guarantees that the larger percentage of our potential viewers will now be out on dates or safely tucked in their beds by the time we come on the air. My optimism in regard to the upcoming season is gone. Shortly thereafter, Gene Roddenberry is gone, too. Angered by NBC's scheduling decisions, Roddenberry offers NBC an ultimatum. Return Star Trek to Monday nights at 7:30, he says, or I walk. Been nice working with you, they reply. Gene's departure vaporizes the last of NBC's dwindling faith in Star Trek, and within the week, they decided to hedge their bets and cut some of their probable losses by hacking generously at our budget. We could no longer afford to shoot on location. We couldn't afford to create many new sets. We couldn't afford many special effects. We couldn't even afford scripts that required